This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington, and here is what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
As a journalist, I look forward to a day when I'll do my work without being harassed, without being intimidated for what I am doing.
That was Ugandan reporter Izaru Daku Franklin on attacks and harassment against media, mostly blamed on the country's security service. Details coming up also. G7. Foreign ministers today called for all parties to the conflict in Ethiopia's Tigray region to exercise restraint. And Niger swears in today newly elected president Mohamed Bazoum. All these and more coming up on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. Sudan's military has an opportunity to emerge from authoritarian rule as a rebranded professional and respected force. But while it's happened in a number of countries, including Nigeria, Ghana, Argentina, and Indonesia, relinquishing power is never easy. Joseph Siegel, director of research at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies, explained to VOA senior analyst Mohamed Al-Shanawi what could prompt the Sudanese military to step back and what benefits the country can gain from a civilian transition.
Despite the seeming advantages of holding on to power, there are in fact quite a few incentives for the military to support the transition. First, I would highlight is its relations with the public. Omar al-Bashir was ousted because there were hundreds of thousands of Sudanese who went onto the streets protesting for change. And should the military try and hang on to power, I suspect we'll see the same thing happen. And the military is going to be in the same untenable position as was al-Bashir. We're seeing a similar dynamic play out right now in Myanmar, where the military there tried to halt the transition. And there are widespread protests that have brought the country to a standstill. And the military there is now more isolated than ever. So I think the Sudanese military were to try to hang on to power, they would lose that public support, which is going to be really important in a democratic environment. I think a second point is with regards to security. Many of the conflicts that Sudan is facing now with armed rebel movements internal to the country, with a move towards democracy and civilian-led rule, we're seeing some of these resolved, and I think we could expect to see the remainder come to closure. And so there's an opportunity that Sudan will be rid of these severe domestic challenges that it's facing on the domestic front. Another issue is with regards to the military institutions itself. Over the years, as the military has become more involved in Sudanese politics, it's become less of a professional force. And so by removing itself from the politics, you can see a reprofessionalization of the Sudanese military. And in the process, and as we've seen with other military transitions, you know, militaries that proactively manage the process, the transition, they end up coming out much stronger. They'll be able to maintain and strengthen the military institutions that emerge under a democratic government than if they wait and are forced to do it under pressure.
So what are the benefits Sudan can gain from a civilian transition?
Well, I think there are many benefits. Of course, there will be more freedom and civil liberties. And with that, there will be more open dialogue and transparency. All these things contribute to better governance. And you know, civilian leaders also do a better job of managing the economic pie and broadening this. So it's likely we'll see a more vibrant Sudanese private sector, commitment to the rule of law, respect for property rights. All these things encourage new business startups, investments, which in turn are going to create jobs and further expand the badly needed productivity for the Sudanese economy. With a growing economy, you know, there's more government revenue, and that in turn is actually going to help the military in terms of giving it some sustained revenue flows around it. With it, you can build a solid institutional foundation for Sudan's security moving forward. And finally, a move to democracy is going to be good for security in Sudan. They'll be able to resolve these remaining civil conflicts in the West and in the South, negotiate with some of the armed militias, bring them into the political process. And, you know, remedying those security threats not only have a huge benefit for the communities that are caught up in them, but it's going to be a big boost for the economy in those locations that will no longer be affected by the devastation that the conflict brings, but for the economy nationally in Sudan.
That was Joseph Siegel, Director of Research at Africa Center for Strategic Studies, speaking with VOA Senior Analyst Mohammed Al-Shanawi. A new report by a media group says security officers are the main perpetrators of violence against journalists in Uganda, with most of the incidents related to coverage of the political opposition. The latest Press Freedom Index Report 2020, compiled by Human Rights Network for Journalists Uganda, says the Uganda police force was responsible for at least 100 of the 174 violations reported last year. The army also was on the list for allegedly depriving journalists of their rights. Reporter Mugume Davis Rawakarinji has more from Kampala, Uganda.
Most of the cases were recorded during the just concluded general elections and in guise of enforcement of COVID-19 government guidelines that critics say were used to hamper the opposition. The report, titled Resilience, Media in the Face of COVID-19 and Elections, said journalists were arrested and assaulted while doing their jobs. Robert Sempala, head of Human Rights Network for Journalists Uganda, says there has been a steady but rising increase in attacks on journalists.
Because in 2018, we recorded 163 cases. In 2019, we recorded 165 cases. And now we have recorded 174 cases. And that points to an escalation of attacks on journalists, field journalists. We've also seen closed media houses, according to this report, simply for hosting the political opposition. So there seems to be efforts that the police and security forces, mainly the army, motivated to attack the journalists covering the political opposition. And that does not augur well with the democracy, according to this report.
Reporter Ezalu Daku Franklin says it's unfortunate that police and other security personnel are not punished for violating media rights that are enshrined in the Constitution.
As a journalist, I look forward to a day when I'll do my work without being harassed, without being intimidated for what I am doing. Every time we are harassed, police has a ready explanation. They feign ignorance. They begin to think that it is our fault that we are beaten.
Earlier this year, Police Inspector General Martin Okoth Ochola shocked reporters when he said police will continue to beat journalists and that it was for their own good.
We are trying to protect your lives. We are telling you there is danger there, but we are insisting you must go where there is danger. Yes, we shall beat you for your own sake. To help you understand that you're going to go where. Yes, we shall use reasonable force to ensure that you don't go where there is a risk. That's what I have no apology. Actually, you are saying, is the police apologizing for mishandling journalists? My answer is, I'm very sorry, excuse me, we shall not apologize.
Brigadier Flavia Biekwaso, spokesperson for the Uganda People's Defense Forces, UPDF, admitted some officers have violated journalists' rights. She says the army has punished and will continue to reprimand those involved in torturing reporters.
I want to begin with, for example, apologizing for where we have gone wrong, for where our soldiers erred. Yeah. For where our soldiers went overboard. But I also want to tell the Ugandans, or to whoever is going to listen to this bite, that this is not the position or this is not the intention of the UPDF as a force to torture Ugandans.
Other reported violators of media rights include the Migration Department, government officials, and youth vigilantes. The report also faulted the media regulatory body, the Uganda Communication Commission, for what it called archaic regulations such as attacks on social media. It also urged political leaders, notably the president, to desist from making statements that undermine the work of journalists. For VOA News, I am Mugume Davis Rwakarinji, Kampala, Uganda.
Around the world, women have disproportionately suffered from the impact of the coronavirus pandemic, and women working in journalism are no different. Advocates say This imperils the rich and important tradition of storytelling. VOA's Anita Powell spoke to one African female journalist who is trying to get stories out despite the challenges. She reports from Johannesburg.
Kim Wall was a fearless journalist. The 30-year-old freelancer had reported from some of the world's toughest places, from Haiti to Uganda to North Korea, and focused on unusual, rarely told stories. But the Swedish national was killed in 2017 on what seemed like a comparatively harmless assignment, interviewing the inventor of a homemade submarine, just kilometers from her childhood home. Voices like hers, big, bold, and female, now are coming under threat in media around the world. While this does not appear to be a concerted effort to suppress female journalists, it's a very real problem, and one that the pandemic is making worse, says Nadine Hoffman, deputy director of the International Women's Media Foundation. The foundation has documented a number of setbacks for female journalists around the world. One trend is particularly worrying. Online vitriol appears to be rising, especially as more people take their lives online.
We have seen an uptick in misogyny and in anti-women rhetoric in online spaces as our lives have basically migrated entirely to those online spaces, which makes sense. And especially in the U.S., for example, around last year's election, I think that the rhetoric about women journalists, and in particular the rhetoric that came from then President Trump towards women who were, for example, covering his administration, was completely reprehensible. And we are hopeful that we are entering now a new era where there will be respect, and that this online violence, we can stand up and say, this is not acceptable, and, you know, it has to stop.
One way the foundation is doing that is by assisting female journalists with financial help and grants, including from a fund in Wall's name that aids reporters whose work furthers her legacy. Zimbabwe-born video journalist Bongani Siziba received a grant from the Wall Fund. She spoke to VOA from her base in Johannesburg.
For me, I'm more interested in stories that hardly make it to the media mainstream, especially stories of girl child, human interest stories. And recently, I grew to like cultural stories.
That's the focus of her grant project, a deep look at well-known South African artist Esther Mahlangu, whose intricate Ndebele paintings have dazzled the international art scene. These are stories that need to be told, Siziba says, because the 85-year-old artist's massive, colorful geometric works are just part of her work. She also runs a school for young female artists at her home in rural South Africa and teaches them how to navigate life in a society notorious for its high rates of violence against women. This story matters, Siziba says, but in these tough times, she can't sell it.
2 weeks after the lockdown started, I received a letter from one of the news agencies I was freelancing for. My contract was terminated, and I didn't know what to do. And weeks again after that, another contract was terminated, so which means I didn't have any source of income. So I had to rely on just going out there doing a story and not knowing who I will sell the story to. So it has been very hard, and we still going on. I don't know how, but COVID-19 has totally changed everything, especially in the media space. For us women, it has been tough.
The pandemic-related economic duress is recent, but the barriers women face in journalism are age-old. Consider, say Hoffman and her colleague Charlotte Fox, the media's reaction to Wall's death, which was ruled a murder.
I mean, she got on a submarine to have an interview with a submarine builder, and people acted like she had done something completely inappropriate by, as a solo female reporter, going to meet her source.
And I was listening to a podcast by some vulture writers on the investigation, and all they could talk about was their disbelief, and they were actually laughing that a woman would get on a submarine to interview this guy, and she shouldn't have done that, and all of this would be prevented.
But these are the facts. It is not Kim Wall's fault she was killed. The woman was just doing her job. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
The G7 group of leading democratic nations today called for all parties of the conflict in Ethiopia's Tigray region to exercise restraint to protect civilians, and respect human rights. The G7 foreign ministers said the group is concerned about reports of abuses and violations of international humanitarian laws. But they acknowledge that Ethiopia's government has pledged to hold accountable those who commit violations and that the Ethiopian Human Rights Commission and the United Nations Commissioner for Human Rights plan to jointly investigate alleged abuses. Ethiopia's Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed, who has acknowledged the presence of Eritrean troops in Tigray amid mounting reports of abuses by all sides, said recently that Eritreans will withdraw. Abiy sent troops into Tigray in November to detain and disarm leaders of the once dominant regional party, the Tigray People's Liberation Front, TPLF, after TPLF forces attacked national military bases. Even though Abiy declared victory within weeks, the International Crisis Group said today that combat has continued in parts of the region. There have been allegations of atrocities by all sides, and both CNN and the BBC reported yesterday they have video evidence that at least 11 unarmed men were shot at the edge of a cliff in Tigray. The shooters in the videos appear to be wearing Ethiopian military uniforms. VOA was not able to immediately corroborate the reports. The BBC, however, reported that the Ethiopian government responded to its inquiries by saying that social media posts are no evidence, but that Tigray is open for independent investigators. A new study warns developing countries will have difficulty recovering from the devastating impact of the COVID-19 pandemic without relief from crushing debt burdens keeping them mired in poverty. The United Nations Development Program is releasing the study ahead of next week's World Bank International Monetary Fund meetings. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
The UN study finds 120 low- and middle-income economies will owe more than $1 trillion in debt service payments this year. It reports 72 countries, classified as vulnerable, are responsible for more than half that accumulated debt. UNDP Administrator Achim Steiner says these 72 countries are facing sovereignty or liquidity challenges that will crowd out important socioeconomic expenditures crucial for the well-being of their people.
We need bold new mechanisms. These are urgently needed to help low- and middle-income countries address crippling debt, which has been sharply worsened by COVID-19 and which will prevent vital investments to tackle poverty and climate change for years to come, investments that we are seeing in a number of wealthier countries now playing out and unfolding. The service of public debt crowds out room for these investments in developing countries.
Steiner says most of the advanced economies are looking forward to a rapid recovery from the pandemic this year. However, the same cannot be said for the poorer countries. He says they are facing increasing poverty as COVID-19 continues to wreak havoc with the physical and economic health of their societies. He says a number of wealthier countries are investing significant amount of money in stimulus packages to tackle the pandemic and boost their economies. He says similar investments are needed in developing countries, adding they would be transformative. For example, he says funding in Africa could help the continent recover from the pandemic based on green energy technology.
There are, as of this year, still 600 million people on the African continent that have no access to electricity. Nothing would be simpler than to drive a recovery and an energy transition with a significant investment in renewable energy infrastructure, helping to both accelerate development on the African continent and accelerate the transition towards a clean energy infrastructure for what will soon be 2 billion people on the African continent by the middle of this century.
UNDP economists say debt distress and vulnerability do not just threaten the poorest countries. They say middle-income countries and small island states also are buckling under heavy debt burdens. They urge delegates attending next week's World Bank IMF meeting to agree to provide liquidity support to all seriously indebted countries. Given the magnitude of the crisis, they say a combination of debt restructuring, additional financing, and reforms are needed. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Worried that Easter may usher in yet another wave of COVID-19, Zimbabwe's government has taken measures aimed at preventing the spread of the coronavirus and the need for further national lockdowns. Reporter Kuzai Zanawashi has the details.
Monica Mutsangwa is the Minister of Information. She highlighted one of the key precautionary measures being taken during the holiday.
Cabinet had agreed that boarding school students should not travel to their homes for the Easter holidays as part of the strategy to curb the spread of the COVID-19 virus. The learners should stay at their respective schools, given the congestion anticipated on public transport during holidays.
Most boarding schools are in rural Zimbabwe. Obed Masaraure is the president of the Amalgamated Rural Teachers Union of Zimbabwe.
The communication was not done in time. Some learners and parents expected to reunite during the Easter holidays.
Despite the late government directive, Masaraure understands why it is needed.
This is still a welcome move given the cost of travel for the parents and also looking at the possibility of spreading of the virus if these learners are going to be allowed to be traveling. We have done a survey and we realized that the safety in our schools stands at an average 25% at national level, which means if we are going to have a third wave, our schools once again become super spreaders of the virus, the schools will be forced to close.
He adds that the government should do more to help schools be safe for both students and teachers. The move has gotten a mixed reaction from parents and teachers. Some say they are missing out on reunions, while others say it is better this way. For VOA, this is Kudzai Zinawashi from Harare.
Niger is swearing in its newly elected president today in the Western African nation's first democratic transfer of power. 60-year-old Mohamed Bazoum succeeds President Mahamadou Issoufou, who is stepping down after two terms in accordance with Niger's constitution. Bazoum, a former interior minister and right-hand man of Issoufou, won the presidency in February with 55.8% of the ballots in a runoff election, according to official results, contested by his opponent, Mahaman Osman. Niger, a country that has suffered four coups d'etats in its history, is currently being ravaged with repeated jihadist attacks from insurgents who advance from Mali in the west and Nigeria in the southeast. And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiyas Wuhit in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbili Abaro, thank you again for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's newsmaker interview program. Join us each Saturday and Sunday when we talk with authors, analysts, and policymakers who provide fresh insight on topics ranging from U.S. politics and foreign policy to science, culture, and global health. You can listen to Press Conference USA on the radio or online at voanews.com/PCUSA. While you're visiting our website, be sure to subscribe to our podcast. We'd also love to hear from you. Just send an email to pcusa@voanews.com or connect with us on Facebook at facebook.com/CarolCastielVOA or on Twitter at CarolCastielVOA. That's Press Conference USA every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat. African Beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bubu music to hip life, bonga flavor to soukous, Afrobeat to ndumbulo and makossa to kwaito. The African beat on VOA has it all. and it's happening right here. Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05 UTC, right after the interview.